listening to KBOO Portland.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. I've been a member of KBOO since 1987. I really appreciate their support of the multicultural community in Portland, Oregon, local music, and the preservation of blues.
This is Barbara Lamorte Cella, and this is the third Thursday edition of Talking Earth. I'm just mastering the art of broadcasting from home with the use of Zoom, the editing program Audacity, and much long-distance advice from Scott Fox, Patrick Bocard, and KBOO engineer Arthur Risotto. This is the first program I'm producing completely alone, so I hope you'll bear with me. Tonight's show features poet Teal Ansari in reading and discussion of her forthcoming book, Dervish Lions. But it unexpectedly opens with a 7 or 8 minute reading of a few of my own poems. The first poem opens in a laundromat. This is from my second book, Rain on Waterless Mountain, which was published in 1996. Unknown Ancestors. Black woman washing her clothes in the laundromat. My daughter's such a good girl, always been a good girl. I don't like to see her walk in the streets like that. Just 'cause her baby's daddy, he won't marry her. She thinks she's getting even with him. But I know she's just hurting herself, doing like that. But you know, something good is gonna come to her. I don't know what it is, but something good's gonna come. I know it because she's a real good girl. Watching her brown face, my eyes grow slippery, I grow shy. But I can't speak what's in my heart, for my tongue's white, and we're not kneeling by a river in Africa, but standing in the laundromat between the pop machines and the packaged bleach, the only sound the roar of the motors. My father was a handsome man, and from the South, a racist. But here's the curious thing. Occasionally, on the street, I catch sight of men who look like him, and those men are always black. Nashville, Louisville, Covington, a common mystery. I think of detergent igloos, of the stains that were washed from the sheets, and the sheets that were washed again and again until they were gray as the half-truths so much is built on. If beds could talk, if every bush and tree and floor could mirror what it knew of birth and dying, if babies were born remembering the places they came from, they'd be born with a cry and a laugh. A deep laughter that warms igloos, a tropical laughter sweeping in over the plains, an African laughter, a Chinese laughter, yes, even an Aryan laughter, muffled as if layers and layers of skirts were hitting the floor. When she is washing her grandson's clothes because her daughter sleeps late after a night of sleepwalking, when she tells me what a good girl her daughter is, and all the while the fact that she's a deep religious woman shines like earthlight. Some long-forgotten cellular knowledge begins again. I hear the laughter of unknown ancestors above the machine's din. The next poem is an excerpt of two sections from a poem called Evolution. Section 2. Where are you now, Jack Kerouac? Your stories from our age of innocence and gasoline dreams. Homeless teenagers sit on curbs watching happy shoppers from another planet, where the petrochemical shopping bags are always full, while panic birds fly over burning pillars of oil. Section 3. The wealthy are connoisseurs of Native American artifacts. Bark decorated with bird quills and beads, pine needle baskets, flint arrowheads. I am an American, native to a land of gasoline guzzlers and green bills. My children, hustling for bucks to stay alive, are native to America too. Whatever wealth my Native American grandchildren can hope for will be measured in fresh water, fir needles, birds, bees, fish, and time. The next poem is from 2010, after the Gulf oil spill, and it opens with a quote from the CEO of the oil company BP. The Gulf of Mexico is a very big ocean. The amount of oil and dispersant we are putting into it is tiny in relation to the local water volume. Tell that to the great egrets and laughing gulls. Whisper that to the blue herons, the muskrat, the alligators. Reassure the fishermen, the ladyfish. Croon it to the burning whale. Tell that to the sickened workers, to their children and grandchildren. The men on the beaches in clean slacks tell flaming lies. Water, our mother, lies flaming at the introitus of land and sea. In the season of heavy water, a moving finger writes a message that only dolphins read, who leap full length out of the water to watch as the world that they live in burns. And the last of my poems that I'm reading tonight is called Eyes. Do you see us wrapped in blankets, pushing shopping carts? Our only protection from nocturnal predators walking all night. Do you see us lying on the sidewalk, cardboard under our spines? We can see you. Get down out of your helicopters. Shut down your drones. Remove your eye from the top of the pyramid. Our sign is the sign of a million hands. In every upstretched palm, a flashing eye. Now we go to the poems of Teal Ansari. My guest tonight is Teal Ansari, whose voice is familiar to followers of poetry on KABU, as she hosts a poetry program of her own called Wider Windows Poetry, which airs on the first Monday of every month at 10 o'clock. Teal is of mixed African-American and Chinese heritage, spent her years from 10 to 17 living in Tanzania with her teacher parents, and returned with them to the States in time to enroll in school at Reed College. In 2005, Teal became a Sufi. Sufism is the mystical branch of Mohammedism, with congregations centered around individual Sufi teachers, each of whom leads their students, or dervishes, in devotional practices which vary from teacher to teacher and congregation to congregation. Central to all of them is discipline and the emphasis on direct experience of the divine. For Teal, who calls herself a warrior poet, poetry is a spiritual practice, a discipline which deepens and enriches her life and keeps her honed and prepared in the hopes that the spirit might come calling. Teal's poetry is as rich and varied as her background, and the spirit quite frequently calls. Tonight she reads from her second full-length collection of poems, Dervish Lions, forthcoming from Fernwood Press. Welcome, Teal.
Thank you, Barbara. It's nice to be here.
I'm glad to have you on the show because I've been aware of and admired your work for 8 or 10 years now. And I was happy to see you get a program on KABU because I knew you'd bring a unique perspective. Can you tell me why you called your show Wider Windows Poetry and what you aim to do with that show?
So the show is focused on the poetry of poets of color, and I call it Wider Window because I hope that listeners will find that it broadens their perspective and give them a wider window on the world. And so I look for poets whose experience is extraordinary, you know, somewhat outside of the mainstream of what most people have experienced, whether culturally or through unique life experiences, through interactions with other languages. I've had a number of bilingual poets on the show, and we've talked about how that influences their poetry, and also poets who work collaboratively with musicians or who are themselves musicians, and sort of the interplay between the poetry and music in their lives. And also, one of the sort of signature elements of the show is that at the end of every episode, I ask my guests a completely random and unrelated to poetry question, which might be something like, what's a place you've always wanted to visit and have never been? A food you've always wanted to try? If you could go back in history and talk with a famous person, who would it be? Fortunately, since I'm recording the show, I can edit That's out all their, gosh, I don't know.
Okay. They're distress sounds. Teal, it would take a wider window than a one-hour show to adequately cover your work, the work you do in the poetry world. You have a blog, which I highly recommend, called Knocking From Inside. And on it right now, it opens with some wonderful advice and tips to anyone who's interested in learning how to construct and organize a poetry manuscript. And the proof of how good this advice is how well organized Dervish Lyons is. The blog is also like a journal, and that Teal posts often, and the posts range from new poems to diary-like entries about what's going on in the city and the world. After I read your book, I was surprised to go to the blog and find a lot of entries about the protests in Portland and about your participation in them. And if we have time later, I'd love to ask you to read a piece from the blog, maybe the John Lewis piece. I doubt that we'll have time, though. I'll give listeners the address of that blog at the end of the show. But before we turn to Dervish Lyons, I'd like you to share a little bit about your poetic background. You really are a self-taught poet.
Yes.
Because although you went to Reed College, you didn't study poetry there, but taught yourself to write. How did you do that, Teal?
So that really began after my conversion to Islam in 2005. So I've really only been a writer for about 15 years. And as part of and after my conversion, I had the impulse to write. Now, as a child, I always thought I'd be a fiction writer. You know, I read a lot of fantasy and science fiction, and that was what I thought I would grow up to write. It never occurred to me that I would grow up and become a poet, but somehow that happened. And so I had this impulse to write. I had this impulse to write poetry, and I didn't know the first thing about it. So I thought, well, I need to learn. And at the time, I wasn't really in a position where I could, you know, go to school again and learn poetry. I was working. I'd been out of school for a number of years. So I just started looking up poetic forms and practiced writing them. And, you know, I went from form to form, and that really helped me develop my poetic tools and learn kind of the music of words and the music of how words sound against each other and how lines sound against each other within the formal framework. And as I grew more confident with that understanding, I transitioned to write more free verse. So form really helped me learn the science of writing, the craft of writing. And I still write a lot of formal poetry, although there isn't very much in the collection Dervish Lions. But I think that formal poetry and free verse are very different tool sets, but are both extremely useful in communicating whatever it is poetry communicates.
Your formal poetry is masterful. You wrote a whole book, which we're not going to talk about here, called High Voltage Lines of Formal Poetry. And there are several sonnets in Dervish Lions, which are to me outstanding because they read so naturally. It isn't even obvious at first that they're hanging on a sonnet's armature. It doesn't slap you in the face with the form, which I feel sometimes when reading formal poetry, that it does that. I'm going to read one of your just a marvelous formal poem from Dervish Lions that was in the first section of the book, and this is called Camellias. This morning sun is not the honey light of summer, thick with golden dust and slow as syrup pouring from a jug. It's bright, but thin and cold, and slanted steep and low across the hillsides. Frost is blooming white, these flowers forced by icy winds that blow as hard this morning as they blew all night. Too cold for rain, but far too dry for snow. And I am restless, pacing to and fro, enduring winter's grip that holds us tight. But my camellias, which somehow know what weather to expect, they're always right, have broken bud. Now scarlet petals glow outside the window where I sit and write.
You read that beautifully.
Well, thank you. And you wrote that beautifully. Do you have any idea why Dervish Lions, though, was turned out to be mostly free verse?
I'd actually produced a couple of collections of formal poetry. High Voltage Lines is one. And then there was another chapbook titled Country Well Known as an Old Nightmare Stable, which actually came out in April, so right after the COVID shutdown hit across the country. So I haven't had a chance to air it very much, which is too bad. But between them, I think those two collections skimmed off a lot of the best formal poetry that I had written.
Let's turn to the book now. It's organized in three parts. The first part, called Kingdom of Wind, are poems from the here and now, from the streets and the mountains and beaches of the Northwest. The second is called Countries of Origin, and it deals with your personal and ancestral past. And the third part, The Province of Saints, deals directly with your experience in living with and wrestling with the spirit. I want to open with a poem from the second section called The Lions of Danzig. First, give us a little background, if you can, about your being in Danzig and sighting those lions. When was it, and what's the story there?
It was the spring of 1981, and as you mentioned, my parents and I had lived in Tanzania for 10 years, and the spring of 1981, we were returning from Tanzania to the United States, and we chose to travel by ship. So we traveled as passengers on a freighter that belonged to Polish Ocean Lines. They happened to be the only freighter line that took passengers that gave us that connection from Tanzania to the U.S. So we traveled on this Polish freighter from Tanzania to Poland, and then in Poland we changed to another freighter, also Polish Ocean Lines, that brought us the rest of the way across the Atlantic to the U.S. So in between there, we spent a couple of days in Poland. Now, the spring of 1981 was a pretty turbulent time in Poland. It was the time of the Solidarity uprisings, and there was a danger of Soviet invasion and suppression of the Solidarity movement, which did actually take place later that year. So when we were there in the spring, in April of 1981, it was pretty hazardous, and the Polish Ocean Lines officials didn't really want us to leave the port. They thought we could be in danger. But we had become friends with one of the officers on the ship, the second officer, and his home was in Gdansk. Gdansk, the city where the Solidarity uprising really began, and which the older name of is Danzig. And he took us to visit Danzig, Gdansk, his hometown. And so that was where the observations that later would grow into this poem sort of occurred. And so this poem is The Lion of Danzig. It's in three parts. Part one, on the old city wall of Gdansk, Freeport Danzig, the lion looks over his shoulder, watching for the return of an exiled king whose name the townspeople still remember. My history is not written on the walls of any city. It's written on the trails worn into sandy soil by countless feet dragging shackles, written on the hungry waves that pulled down hulls full of living freight. The names of my kings have been forgotten. With the cold Atlantic ahead of me, I asked the Lion of Danzig, do you ever get tired of looking back? Isn't history a heavy load to carry? He said, I'm stone. I was made this way. You can look both ways. Part two. The weight of those stones resisted cannonball and tank shell, riot and revolution. Generations raised in their shadows spoke a tongue unchanged from the Middle Ages. I was feather light, air suspended in transit between two continents, fluent in a language I was not born to. I asked the Lion of Danzig, did you ever want to learn another language? Visit another country? He said, my job is here. I was made to guard this wall. You ask too many questions. Part three. Leaning in the shadow of old stones, the mellow warmth of stones in sun, the cool shadow of stones in summer near water, I think of the Lion of Danzig, who gave no answers. I've learned not to ask too much from stones, though I still have questions.
Teal, what did you mean by the line, I've learned not to ask too much from stones?
So I think there's a tendency for people to want to look for answers in the world, you know, look for signs or omens or messages. And, you know, we ask these questions of the world, and the world may answer and may give us messages, but it's not really required to. There's no obligation on the part of a stone to tell you what you need to know. Sometimes you need to figure it out yourself.
Right. In this poem, the lion tells you that you can look both ways as a flesh and blood being, forward and back, and you do that in the book. And I want to switch to the first section of the book, the here and now, and ask you to please read At the Japanese Peace Garden.
Okay, so this poem is about the Japanese Peace Garden in Waterfront Park, which if you live in Portland, you probably are familiar with Waterfront Park, and you have seen the stones there with the haiku engraved on them. At the Japanese Peace Garden in Waterfront Park, the boulders stand brown and angular like neglected teeth. Chiseled kanji spell out the haiku of exile across their weathered faces. Here, a glimpse out a train window of a home rolling backward out of sight. There, the names of camps. Desert stretches away beyond barbed wire. Today, cherry petals were falling, stroking the surfaces of stone. Today, a young couple was being photographed in a bridal dress and a natty suit, holding each other under the flowering trees and drinking from opposite sides of a fountain, like their parents sipping from opposite ends of an ocean. I thought the rocks had turned to a row of old women, wiping drops of Oregon rain from their stone faces. I wanted to line up a row of pebbles at their feet and say, "Here, grandmothers, here are your grandchildren."
Stones again. Here again. Stones have a special meaning for you.
And perhaps I learned not to ask them questions.
Yes, but still, they are significant players. Your imaginative realm, stones. And you had a life-changing experience, not related to stones, but related to a mountain here in Oregon. And I'd like to have you again, this is from the first section, Poems of the Northwest. I'd like you to read Thunder Skullface and give us a little background on that, what you were doing there, and a little bit of background before you read the stone.
So this poem takes place out in southeastern Oregon on Steens Mountain, which is a big fault block mountain that sits out in the middle of a bunch of empty desert lake beds. And it's a very unique place. It's part of the Malheur National Monument, which is a wildlife sanctuary, bird sanctuary, and there's a research station there which does a lot of field biology and also has a lot of educational programming. And so when I was in college at Reed, the summer after my junior year, I took a field course through the Malheur Field Station, and it was a botany course, so I was doing field work. And as part of this course, I spent 4 weeks camping out on Steens Mountain by myself, not for continuous weeks. I would go back on the weekends and get food and, you know, do laundry, stuff like that. But so that there was most of 4 weeks that I was out there, and this was in the early 80s. We didn't have cell phones. I didn't really have any means of communication, so I was completely isolated while I was out there. So it was a psychologically strange environment, as well as a physically very strange environment. It's this big mountain. It's out in the middle of a desert. It breeds up very strange weather. And this poem, I think, conveys some of the physical nature of the environment. So I'll go ahead and read it. Thunder Skullface. That afternoon on Steens Mountain, Thunder came walking up the valley in his black hat and white tails. Bolts blasted the ridge above my head. Giant feet of ice stomped the stone. He poked his bony face into the tent where I huddled, poles bending under the weight of massed hail. "Hey, Teal, watch me pick up this tent and sail it off the mountain." I'd been there alone most of 4 weeks, walking the mountainside, mapping shrinking snowfields, drawing transects to measure the swift eruption of life in that short, short summer. At 9,000 feet, the air is thin and sun is savage, knife-shaped, will scar your retinas. You can go snowblind standing on bare rock. Meanwhile, the sear basins a mile below swirl with alkali dust and spit up strange weather. That's where I dreamed I wasn't the only me. My parents had an older daughter by the same name. She died. There was a car crash. I knew this in my dream. And I was second born and named for her. Or I was her daughter, somehow rescued from the wreckage of her body. My parents or grandparents hid this truth. So I would believe I was the only Teal ever. Unique, isolate, atomic, island as no man truly is. Like this mountain in the middle of a desert ringed by long dead lakes, part of no cordillera, no great divide, no family of shining peaks linked by tales of quarreling brothers and beautiful sisters. Steens Mountain has no siblings. I have no sister by the same name as me. Thunder Skullface laughed. think you're special because you've got a funny name? Think you don't have any sisters? Think again.
I love your personification of thunder. And I wanted to ask you, you said that that month set alone on Steen's Mountain had a very, very deep effect on you. Can you say a little bit about what changed, what perspective that gave you?
So a couple of things that I think happened. One is this storm, which really was, as I've described it, an extremely violent storm, and was my first experience as an adult of mortal fear. I really was afraid that I could die in this storm. It was so violent, and lightning was striking, you know, not very far away. And though I didn't think about it at the time, there was also risk of flash floods, hypothermia, all this sort of thing. So the fear of death and the awareness of death kind of became, I became more, much more conscious of this at that point. And the other thing is, and especially with reference to the dream about there having been someone else with my name, which I had never met anyone with my name. Still to this day, I have not actually met anyone who shares my first name. I've met a couple of people who said they know someone who has the same first name as me. But I had a very strong sense of my own uniqueness linked to this name. And so for me to have a dream in which I'm questioning that, questioning my own identity, to me suggests there was something going on very deep in my psyche, which I still can't consciously elucidate, but which was in some way linked to my identity and to the isolation and probably the lack of how we define ourselves against other people. And how do you do that when there aren't other people around?
You know, I have a couple of poet friends who had very profound mystical experiences, not on Steen's Mountain, but camping on the desert below Steen's Mountain. And I think that that's some kind of spiritually charged landscape. There's a word for that, and I can't remember what it is now, but it's like spaces, sacred spaces. And, you know, I'm going to have to, after the show, look it up and refresh my mind as to what the word is. You have, I'd like to ask you to read one more word, one more poem, rather, from section one, which is The Lion Tamer. Could you read that one?
Sure. The Lion Tamer. Behind the Fred Meyer in a small coastal town, a wave of sand is frozen against the sky. Silhouette of a sleeping lion, softened by grass like pale fur. Every day, hard-edged grains spill into the parking lot. Every week, a truckload of sand is hauled off and dumped. Wind and tide and marching sand would eat this coastline, devour whole towns. Except that dune grass stopped the lions in their tracks and made them lie down, tamed their relentless hunger, dulled the flying claws that scraped paint from walls of houses every windy afternoon. Lion tamer, you build solid ground, safe harbor for deep roots, but I yearn to run over rippling sand as gulls fly over water. Let the sleeping lions rise up, fur streaming wild in the wind. Let them shed their chains of braided grass and bury the highway with immense tawny paws. Let their silica teeth scour away my flesh. Let my bones lie white and polished in the lair of lions.
Awesome. Here's another poem that talks about stones and maybe helps explain why the lion tamer hopes for the lion to be untamed. This is a poem from the Countries of Origin section, Bagamoyo. Could you read that for us?
Okay. So Bagamoyo is the name of a city on the coast of East Africa, actually in Tanzania, that is a port and at one time was a major departure point for the slave trade, the Indian Ocean slave trade. And the meaning of the word Bagamoyo is, here I lay down my heart. Mm-hmm. Here is the stone I dreamed full of voices, echoing the clink of chains in a ship's hull, stinking of sweat that dried without seeing daylight. Here is the stone that listened where no ear of flesh would hear the captive's cry, the driven slave, stone that captured the crack of the foreman's whip. Here is the stone I dreamed dancing to no drum. Here is the great heavy stone that sat in the center of the slave mart, round rock crowned with rusty rings and broken links. Here is the auctioneer's altar, the seat of barter, the seal of sale, the coast where ships waited, holds hungry for human cargo. Here is the stone where they laid down their hearts.
I think we have time for you to read the poem Books.
So this poem begins with an epigraph. It's a quote from Franz Kafka, and he says, "A book should be an axe to break the frozen sea within us." Well, that's ambitious, to think pack ice would yield to a little chopping with a hatchet. Why not say a book should be the Gulf Stream? A book should be global warming. A book should be an icebreaker with bows of steel wrapped in colored cardboard. Or should a book be a pod of harbor seals running silent under the ice of your soul, occasionally pausing to chew an inconspicuous breathing hole? Or a bear, half snow and half aquatic, prowling the Arctic scape as if it owned the place? A book might be a willow-aw throwing clouds of frozen snow the size of mountains into a blue ice sky the size of continents. Or the aurora, sunless rainbow reflected in 1,000 mirrors of shattered ice, a lane of black water between walls of white, a pool of fresh water on the surface of a frozen fjord. A book could be a rowdy, quarreling flock of Arctic terns coming home from 3 years at sea. My father read to me when I was young. Books came, sober-plumaged and gaudy, to perch on every swaying branch in the jungles of my heart. See me now, bringing you dropped feathers by the handful.
Feathers, perhaps, from the Angel of Poetry, Living with Angels, your poem, Living with Angels. It's reminiscent, of course, of Rilke's poem, Every Angel is Terrible. And just as a good example of what a big difference translation can make, I have seen that line, every angel is terrible. I saw it translated somewhere as, an angel alone is misted in dread.
I would be very interested in seeing a careful analysis of that translation, because the word terrible, of course, comes from the word terror. Nowadays, we use it in sort of a casual way, say, oh, the traffic's terrible, we can't get anywhere, it's so slow, but it really should mean terrifying.
And it comes across as terrifying, certainly, in that Rilke poem. And you talk about something that terror in a different way. Do you want to read it? Living with Angels.
Living with angels is like living with lightning roaming round the house, waking up to the hiss and crackle of flame-edged feathers coming up through the floor like shark fins. It's knowing every door is guarded by a red-hot sword. It's warnings from the voices on the radio that make you shiver for no reason. It's uncanny. Angels are not made out of spun sugar or sunbeams. Angels rock the boat we think of as the universe like whales breaching underfoot. Angels introduce themselves with fear not and take their leave with God's will be done, whether you like it or not.
another poem from that last section that I really, really want you to read is Waiting on the Bus Stop with Eunice Imrie. And if you want to tell us, give us a heads up, a little bit of information about who Eunice Imrie was and when he lived.
Yeah, so Eunice Imrie was a Turkish poet, a Sufi poet, a little later than Rumi, so kind of in the heyday of Turkish Sufism. But unlike Rumi, who's much better known in the West, Eunice Imrie was an uneducated man. He's sometimes referred to as the peasant poet. He was probably illiterate. His poems were all written down by other people, but he wrote vast amounts of really, I think, beautiful devotional poetry, and much of it actually is incorporated into the liturgy of my particular Sufi order. Much of it is meant to be sung. And Eunice Imrie hasn't been translated a lot, but there's a good translation of a small selection of his poems. It's titled The Drop That Became the Sea, Lyric Poems of Eunice Imrie, and the translators are Kabir Helminski and Refik Algan. And so there are a lot of lines from that book from Eunice Imrie in this poem, which is titled Waiting for a Bus with Eunice Imrie. And it's inspired by Billy Collins' Shoveling Snow with Buddha. You know, the idea is you're doing some kind of everyday thing, shoveling snow, waiting for a bus, washing dishes, and in it you're in dialogue with this religious figure. And so this imagines me in a dialogue with Eunice Imrie while we're waiting for a bus together. Waiting for a bus with Eunice Imrie. The sun is up behind clouds. Damp leaves are stuck to the sidewalk. Eunice says, don't dwell in images. Each flower has a thousand ways it flirts with truth. The bus is late and my feet are cold, Eunice. Who has time to be bored? These sighs are love's clothing. I worry about the state of the world. What can one person do? Even a weak falcon is a falcon still. What blocked Solomon's way was an ant. I never know if my poems are any good. When you have brought the pearl to the surface, a jeweler is needed to know its worth. I never know if my poems are true. Some people get their share of revelations, and some people go deeper. Eunice, what's the use of poetry anyway? Let the deaf listen to the mute. A soul is needed to understand them both. But what makes a really good poem? We entered the house of realization. We witnessed the body. How do you want us to remember you, Eunice? Let my poems be scattered. May Eunice hop like a partridge.
Wondering if you, what you have to say about the line, some people get their share of revelations and some people go deeper.
Well, this is one of Eunice Imrie's lines, so I'm not able to say exactly what he was thinking. But if I would apply it to our circumstances, I think that there are some very superficial rewards that can come with spiritual practice. And it's very easy to do a little bit of practice and say, oh, I've had a revelation. I'm done. And you stop. You know, your spiritual growth stops right at that point. And it takes a much deeper discipline to say, yeah, fine, I've had a revelation, but I still don't have the truth. I don't have the whole truth. I need to keep trying. I need to keep practicing and deepen my surrender to get closer to the truth or more of the truth. I can do miracles. That doesn't matter. I still don't have the whole truth. So it's really about continual deepening and
questioning. And if you're a Zen Buddhist, one of your questions might be, who the hell am I anyway?
Right.
You know, we talked a little bit before the show about spirituality, Teal, and it's my contention that all poetry is spiritual, whether the poet realizes it or not, because all poetry directly reflects the poet's spirit, and that spirit might be flying high, or it might be cruising along in hands-off cruise control, or it could be hiding in a hole, or it could be digging deep to try to unearth treasures, but it's always reflected in the poetry. And I love the spirit that's reflected in your poems. I want to refer people to your blog. I think, though, that we will have a little time more, and I'm going to ask you to choose several other poems to read.
Okay, would you like me to read more from the book or from the blog?
Well, it's your choice.
So I'm going to read a couple more poems from the book, Dervish Lions, and I'll read a couple of poems from the last section. And the first one I'd like to read is titled, It Was the Wind. No, I tell you, it's the wind made me drunk, lifted me, spun me, filled my pores like wine in so many cups, like a path leading out of sight through the sharp green smell of mountain firs, like a bowl of bronze humming with pleasure as it stroked around the rim. The world's full of drunkenness and rowdy singers staggering late at night toward home or away, it hardly matters, because they relish the stink of alleys as much as jasmine perfume. To the sacred, all is sacred. But I was telling you about the wind that pelted us with acorns. I was telling you that wet leaves blowing down the sidewalk sound nothing like dry. I was telling you about the way summer refused to leave even a trace of ash. I'll let go of your jacket now. I have to go drink some more.
I'm glad you chose to read that. I'm glad I heard it.
And then the other one that I wanted to read is titled, Brother Death, Won't You Walk With Me? The path through the forest is dark. A bony hand is more comfort than no hand at all. The rapids roar with white spray. Your teeth gleam beside me. The path winds through a tight gut of stone. Click, clack, say your fingers. Sun glows on the peak of the mountain before us, sparks in the eternal night of your eye socket. The angels are arguing about whether I should go on. You stand silent and motionless. I drink emptiness from the bowl of the moon. You have taken the unfinished book from my hand.
Oh, that's beautiful. Again, I'm glad that you chose to read that, Teal. Your blog is a very, very rich one. And it's called Knocking from Inside, which is a line from the 13th century Afghani Persian poet Rumi.
Yes.
The address of the blog, well, did I tell you that that there's a lesson on it? I mean, if people want to go on it right away, the first thing that'll come up will be really good information about how to organize a book. But it's very rich with poetry and also life experiences and occasional news things about what's happening with the protests in Portland. So I'd love to have you read something from your blog. I think you might even have time to read the generational poem, but if you choose not to, I mean, you could do it, and I could see.
I think I'd rather read a couple of short poems, okay. Shorter poems that are also quite recent. So this one is from July 23rd. And it's titled, A Beautiful Evening, A Beautiful Night. Come downtown when shadows pool beneath skyscrapers and topaz light lingers above. Come under the whispering elms at Chapman Square. Smell the smoke at Riot Ribs and smile. Twilight will hang in the air for hours before clouds of tear gas surround the courthouse. Sway to drums with the rest of the crowd. Sway to the cadence of the black preacher on the steps. Someone's boombox is playing reggae. There'll be LRAD and flashbangs later. In the last rays of the sun, I read legal aid's number written on my arm by a stranger with a Sharpie. The day's heat fades to gentle warmth. My fist in silhouette against the darkening sky. It's a beautiful evening for insurrection. It's a beautiful night to start a revolution.
I love that. Okay.
And then another poem that I wrote, and I wrote this back in 2008. I wrote it on November 4th after President Obama was elected. And one of the things that had happened in the previous couple of days was I had seen Congressman John Lewis, who recently passed away, being interviewed on television about the historic victory of President Obama. And Congressman Lewis was in tears. And normally I hate it when, you know, you interview people on television and they're crying, and usually it's because they've experienced some terrible tragedy and it's such an invasion of their privacy. But in this case, he was so dignified and so intensely joyful in those tears that I felt it was such a gift. It was such a gift to all of us that he was able to shed those tears. And so I wrote this poem and I reposted it recently in memory of Congressman Lewis. And the poem is titled Heirloom Diamonds. I'm too young to remember most of that. The marches, Connor's dogs and Little Rock, the noose, the burning cross, the midnight knock. The woman on the bus who simply sat and wouldn't move. The brave young volunteers whose bodies drowned in Mississippi mud. My right to vote was paid for with their blood, transformed to treasure by the passing years. They didn't care how long they had to wait. The old folks queued to vote. I watched them cry for joy this time, instead of grief or fears or bitter anger. We drove back the hate another step this time, and you and I inherit diamonds in these old men's tears. November 4th, 2008. Okay. So I'd like to also read a poem titled Sense for Rain. And one of the things I should note about the poems in the central section of this book, Countries of Origin, many of them address my experience living in Tanzania and transitioning from there. But they're not really poems of memory. They're not really memory poems. In many ways, they're more poems about the process of memory and the effects of memories. They're a little more distanced. And I think this poem sort of illustrates that. It's titled Sense for Rain. Years ago, the dust fine as flour and burned by sun, caked to our sweat, blackened every crease of skin. We watched for the monsoon as sailors watched for land, waited like lovers, lying awake, impatient with heat. We knew the signs, felt in our bones the trade winds shift, pushing towers of cumulus above the Indian Ocean. Lines of squall stalked landward on spidery legs of rain. The electric smell of those first drops carried miles on the wind. That sense for rain lives in my bones. It's easy to forget in a Portland winter, rain is like air after all. And I seek the warm spot by the wood stove, cherish mild days, cross the street to walk through a rare patch of sun. But every fall, I feel moisture pressing against the Coast Range. I dream of dust, cracked dry mud flats, wet crystallized to salt. I wake, and lie waiting for rain as for a lover.
Teal Ansari, reading from Dervish Lions and sharing a little bit from her blog with us. I want to thank you, Teal. Teal's program on KBOO airs the first Monday of every month at 10 o'clock. And Teal, can you tell us who your next guest will be?
My next guest will be named Bella, and she's a local poet, a slam poet, winner of many awards. And I hope you will all tune in and listen to her.
And I hope you will all go to Teal's blog, which is one word, knockingfrominside.blogspot.com?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to repeat that again. knockingfrominside.blogspot.com. And I also hope that you will... Dervish Lions is not out yet, and also Teal just won a prize. She just won a prize for another book. I mean, this woman is on fire right now. And the book is I'm trying to find. Tell us, is it the Poetry Box?
Yes, it's a chapbook that will be coming out from the Poetry Box probably in February. And it's titled The Day of My First Driving Lesson, and it's about my parents, both of whom passed away in 2018 and 2019.
Okay, and Dervish Lions will be out when?
Spring of 21. We don't have an exact date yet, so after the day of my first driving lesson, but probably within a couple of months after.
Okay. The poet, once again, is Teal Ansari, A-N-S-A-R-I. And the program tonight is Talking Earth. My name is Barbara Lamorticella. I am here every 2 months. It'll be October. I'll do another show. I think I'm going to do a show in honor. We've lost some greats in the last couple years, and two of them that I really need to memorialize, and I'm going to start out with Ursula Le Guin, and another absolutely marvelous poet in Oregon was Peter Sears, a lovely man, and I want to do a program on him, but I think in October, anyway, it'll be the third Monday in October, and I believe that, although I haven't started working on it yet, that we'll do a memorial program for Ursula Le Guin. And tune in on the first Monday, every Monday of the month at 10 p.m. there's poetry on KBOO. There's a wonderful show called Occasions, and Teal has her show, and Dan Raphael is going to come on board as a host.
Excellent.
Eminently. And of course there's Walt, the old man of the sea, Walt Curtis, you know. So thank you so much, Teal. Thank you everyone for listening, and stay tuned. This is KBOO Portland, deeply grateful to our listeners and supporters, and deeply grateful to the staff at KBOO that's been doing such a wonderful job of keeping things going here.
Thank you, Barbara.
And we'll talk to you again, Teal. Bye.
Bye.
KBOO Portland.
Ever wonder what happens to your Fred Meyer reward points? Now you can turn them into excellent community radio by linking your Fred Meyer rewards card to KBOO. Look up KBOO or our ID number 86634 at fredmeyer.com.